Good morning and welcome back to The Conversation. This is Catherine Cruz. Today is April 12th. Here in Hawaii, hundreds of people are in need of donated organs. Some die waiting for a vital organ, but there's also a great need for cornea or bone transplants to help lead healthier lives, according to the Legacy of Life. Honolulu resident Carol Evans lost her son Brian in 2014. He was 31 years old when he fell from a high-rise in Waikiki. A section of railing he and his friends were leaning on gave way. Evans shared that at first she said no to the idea of donating her son's organs, but she changed her mind, and she's glad she did.
We were at Queens Trauma Center, and they had asked us if we wanted to speak to a chaplain or someone from Legacy of Life, and of course I said no, because it just seems like that's the only thing you have control of at the time, right? Your ability to say, no, leave me alone, get away from me. And so I said no. But no really didn't mean no. You know, once I had a chance to reflect and settle down and think about what my son would want, he was quite young, so he had not completed a donor card. And so I thought about it, and then at that point I said, there's no way we cannot donate.
And so what was that process like for you?
Well, they came in, you know, we had a family meeting with the trauma center doctors, and the Legacy of Life staff came in. We were introduced to their chaplain, Susie Gaffney, and then there was paperwork to fill out. There was explanations. You know, you go through a lot of big questions when it comes to the time, you know, you have religious questions, all sorts of questions. So they were there basically just to take the journey with us and guide us, but they allowed us just to make the decisions. There was no forcing or anything of that nature. They were just there basically just to be on the journey with us, and they're still on that journey after 4 years. It's pretty amazing how they're there. They have, you know, functions for the families to bring the families together who share that same type of loss, who understand. At first I thought, oh, I'm not like all these folks, but I learned I was just like them, and I learned how to appreciate, you know, the support that the Legacy of Life gives the donor families.
And share with our listeners what it meant to you knowing that other people were helped.
Well, actually, that was one of the greatest comforts, to know that because, you know, he lived, and even because he died, that others could live and thrive, and that they could be recipients of this priceless gift. You hate to think of your loved one as living in vain. And just the fact that at least three of his organs were shared, one with a 76-year-old widow, one with a 27-year-old single mother, and another one with a U.S. vet. And that in and of itself was very touching.
And so really then you were comforted by
Absolutely.
That.
Great comfort. Great comfort. Knowing that someone else lived in, just knowing our son, he would also, you know, he was a very unselfish young man, and he would have also been very happy, I think.
Carol Evans said she is still connected to Legacy of Life, which helped her through that grieving process. She plans to be at a remembrance ceremony this Saturday, which brings together donor families and recipients. Felicia Wells-Williams has been with Legacy of Life for almost 24 years. She sat down with us to talk about what the group does to support families during their time of need.
We are just overwhelmed often by what families share with us and their willingness to give hope to others through the gift of donation. Sometimes they are honoring the wishes of their loved one. They've known those wishes. And many times they're making decisions on behalf of their loved one.
And you folks hope to be able to reach people so they check that box on their driver's license.
Absolutely. You know, I think that is really one of the big messages from us in our public education efforts and our community outreach is to encourage people to make that lifetime decision, make a decision and check the box. But what I really hope that people walk away with is more than just the action of checking the box, really understanding the why. And the reason why you should consider checking the box is because when you do so, when you make a decision to be a donor and save someone else's life, you're really giving the precious gift of time. And I think all of us who've experienced the death of a loved one would think, if I just had a few more minutes, what if I had a little more time that I could be with someone who touched me and inspired me and was such a critical part of my life? What would I do with that little more time? And that's really what donation is. It's the gift of just a little while longer.
Sometimes the donors don't meet the recipient's families.
Many times, and actually I'd say probably more often than not, recipients and donor families will not meet. So it really is a precious gift that's given. It's given in the hope that it's going to save someone else's lives, and families then find comfort in knowing they've done that. Many of our Hawaii families will get a letter, or they'll be able to communicate in writing anonymously, and then very rarely, but really wonderful times, we're able to bring together recipient and donor family so that they can have an opportunity to learn about each other. It's so important for the community to know. Donation not only impacts the recipient, but it is in many ways, it's a gift to the family, because as Carol can express, I'm sure, in her own eloquent words, it's that hope for the future. It's knowing that the death was not in vain. It's knowing that a little part of your loved one is continuing to give hope and life to someone else. And for many grieving families, that's the lifeline that keeps them hanging on, something for them to hold on in some of their darkest days.
For some families, though, it's particularly traumatic, and they may not want to deal with that question. So really, you check that box on your driver's license, that it may make that transition easier.
It does. And our intent when we're working with families is always to talk to them in the timing that is right, to present information in a timing that is right. So whether the loved one made the decision on their own, or whether a family is in a position of making the decision on behalf of their loved ones, we want to do that in time that is sensitive and is done as compassionately as possible. And yes, for many families, knowing the wishes of their loved one is what has helped them, because, you know, if you don't know what someone wants, you may defer to know. You may think, well, I'd rather not make that decision on their behalf. And so that then means that someone else's life isn't saved. But of course, we understand and respect every family's wish. So when you make it ahead of time and your family knows that, that helps them also at that time.
And can you talk about the need in our community?
You know, there are several hundred people in Hawaii right now waiting for life-saving organ transplant. Primarily in Hawaii, we have patients on the waiting list for kidneys. Kidney disease is something that really severely affects people in Hawaii due to hypertension. Diabetes can also have impact on the kidneys. And so these are patients who would otherwise rely on regular dialysis. So a kidney transplant saves them from that and allows them to return to work and be able to provide for their family. Also, patients waiting for a liver transplant, sometime related to liver failure through cancer or hepatitis or other liver failure due to, you know, toxic exposure, that type of thing. And I think the Queen's Medical Center is bringing back their pancreas transplant program. So there's probably a few people in Hawaii also waiting for a pancreas, and that's patients who are diabetic who would no longer need insulin if they can receive a pancreas transplant.
Are there any myths out there that you'd like to dispel?
Oh, wow, that's such an awesome question. There are so many myths out there, but I think the primary thing that often families or people are afraid of, they think that if they make a decision to be a donor, that somehow the care that they receive in the hospital would be less than optimal so that they could become an organ donor. And I would want everybody to know that nothing is further from the truth. In most cases, the hospital, the doctors and the nurses that are caring for you in those critical moments have absolutely no knowledge of your wish to be a donor. That's what our team is able to research once we're called in. But we're only called in once all of the life-saving efforts have failed and now death is either imminent or death has occurred. And so that would be really critical for people to know, that when you make a decision to be a donor, you're making a life-saving decision, but you're not making a decision that's going to change the absolutely wonderful care that you will receive when you're in need in any of our Hawaii hospitals.
And for someone, let's say, who is diabetic, is there any reason why any of their other organs or tissues might be rejected?
You know, we're always really careful in evaluating every donor. And so I would encourage anyone who wants to be a donor to designate themselves a donor. Check the box. And when your time comes, when you are no longer alive, we will determine if you have a gift that you can give. So it's really best for us as individuals not to eliminate ourselves, because we'd be surprised. In fact, you know, several years ago, we had a gentleman who was blind because he had been affected by diabetes, and yet he gave the gift of his cornea and gave the gift of sight. How extraordinary that
wow.
even you could give a gift that you yourself had already lost.
That's quite a story. So, yes. So people, there really is incredible hope.
Absolutely.
That comes with a transplant story.
Yes, it is.
Anything else?
I think just really hoping that people will think about this decision, really make a decision for yourself. Talk to your family about it. Talk about how you can make the difference in the life of someone else. Because when I think about it, you know, myself as a nurse and, you know, and even within my own family, it's like, if you could save someone else's life, wouldn't you do it? And that's what organ donation is. You give a gift of life to someone else.
And Carol Evans talked about the remembrance ceremony that's coming up this weekend. Share with our listeners what that's like.
We have an annual ceremony that we do every year to honor families from throughout the island. So families will come from every island and gather. We'll be out at Ko'olau Ballrooms on Saturday. We have a full day of healing and hope for donor families. We'll start in the morning with a indoor nature activity called Growing Forward, where we're going to talk about how to take care of yourself when you're grieving and do that through nurturing a plant and also nurturing ourselves. Then there'll be an opportunity for families to pin a square on the Memorial Hawaii Donor Quilt. So families make a square in honor of their loved one. Often they'll use items of clothing or other things that were important in the life of their loved one. They'll create this memorial square and have an opportunity to pin that. And then we'll follow that with a luncheon and a brief program where recipients and donor families will share their reflections. We have a special musical guest that's a surprise that we're really excited about. And then we'll close our time together with a monarch butterfly release. It's just extraordinary, a precious time for families to release a butterfly in honor of their loved one and just be surrounded by the beauty of nature.
So it's a really touching ceremony.
It really is.
Lots of healing.
Yes.
That was Felicia Wells-Williams, Director of Family Services for Legacy of Life. For links to learn more about the Organ Donor Program, you can check our webpage at hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz, and this is The Conversation. And now we're going back to Pledge Table for an update. And thanks to our friends at Pledge Central, this is Catherine Cruz. You're back joining us with The Conversation. Samoan communities across the U.S. continent and in the Pacific will be watching the progress of a lawsuit filed in Utah recently. Associated Press reporter Sophia Yan was the first to report on the complaint filed by a Utah man who believes it's wrong that he's being denied U.S. citizenship and the right to vote just because he hails from American Samoa. It's the dilemma of being a U.S. national rather than a U.S. citizen. It's the second such case to go before the courts.
So in 2016, the Supreme Court had denied to review a particular ruling from a lower court that had essentially upheld a very long-term view of American Samoa, which doesn't necessarily have full constitutional rights. This goes back from a really long time, back to colonial days. And so American Samoans right now who are born there, they are considered U.S. nationals. They're not U.S. citizens. And what that means is that while they pay U.S. taxes to Uncle Sam, they are not allowed to vote. They have trouble getting certain jobs, for instance, government jobs that require you to be a citizen. And, you know, they can't run for office. They can't sponsor family members for immigration or serve on a jury. So there's a group of American Samoans living in Utah right now who have taken a suit. They've filed against the State Department asking to be recognized now finally as U.S. citizens. I spoke to the lead plaintiff on that case, John Fitis Manu. He works for a lab company out in Utah, and you know, he says that this is just something that's quite embarrassing for him because when he's at work, his friends, his colleagues, they sort of joke about it. They're like, oh, you know, you're not a citizen, you're an alien. And he thinks that this is just a really tough way to live. You know, for him, what he was saying to me is that it's quite embarrassing when it comes around to elections, to voting time. He doesn't ever really engage. He sits at his cubicle. He's quiet. He wants to be part of the conversation, but literally, physically, legally cannot.
Right. And here in Hawaii, we've got lots of Samoans who have relatives that live in American Samoa, and they see this dilemma firsthand.
Yeah, I think it's obviously a difficulty in terms of trying to be able to participate in fully in American civil life for these American Samoans. You know, it's a nuanced issue. Some people think, local authorities, for instance, have in the past before us, and that they think, you know, this is something that should be decided in a different way by individuals, that they should continue to have the ability to choose whether they would like to be a U.S. citizen or a U.S. national. You know, there are some legal scholars who interpret this to say that, you know what, the 14th Amendment in the Constitution clearly applies to American Samoans. That's what a lot of these experts and law professors I spoke with had said. So it's still sort of up for debate. But again, this is a case that's just been brought, a story that we broke over at the AP. And, you know, for these people, what they're looking for is to be recognized just like everybody else, just like that other American down the street. And they don't see why they shouldn't be, because they do everything else. They abide by American laws. They pay U.S. taxes. They lived here their whole lives. And they just want to be able to have the same rights.
And do we have a sense of numbers? How large, you know, this might affect the people either living in Utah or Hawaii or just abroad?
Yeah, so in Utah, Utah's got one of the largest Pacific Islander communities in the U.S. Obviously, Hawaii has a big one, California as well. They also have a larger state population. Now, there are about 100,000 Samoans living in the U.S., I believe. There's a split, I think, between American and independent Samoans, but still there is quite a large community for that. So this is an issue that, at least for them, they're certainly aware of. And in terms of how this particular ruling goes, I mean, you know, we'll have to just wait and see what the courts decide. But what's interesting is that if the courts do rule favorably on this case, in John's favor, then that means we get this thing called a circuit split. So that would be a different decision than what was previously decided in a D.C. court. And that might actually mean that the Supreme Court, that the federal government will have to review it a little bit sooner, that they might be pressured to look at it again to make some sort of, to just make some sort of judgment or to say what their stance is.
Right. And because immigration is top of mind these days, there's the concern about the census and everything else. It's just interesting, the timing of this lawsuit.
Well, I think that this lawsuit was in the works, from what I understand, from what I when I spoke with the lead attorney, Neil Ware, about it. You know, I think this lawsuit was in the works for some time. He had led that previous lawsuit, the one that finally stalled in 2016 at the Supreme Court level. And he himself is from Guam, so he's quite interested in this kind of issue when it comes to rights and laws and all these things as they apply to the territories, the Commonwealth, and the U.S. You know, these are places that are out in the middle of the ocean, right? So for many times for mainland U.S., it's like really far-flung to be thinking about all of this. And so I don't think that this lawsuit in particular is linked to the current immigration debate, but it does come at a very interesting time for the country.
Right, and I grew up in Guam, and I have siblings who were born in Guam. I was born on the mainland. So while my vote for the president counts, theirs really doesn't. It is this kind of second-class citizenship treatment that that some folks are trying to reverse.
Yeah, that was exactly what John said. He said he thought of himself, and unfortunately thought of himself, as a second-class citizen, a B-rated citizen, because he just doesn't have the same rights that his wife, a U.S. citizen, and his children, also American citizens, have, even though, again, he's paying taxes to Uncle Sam and abides by the laws. And, you know, he's by the book, the way he lives his life is just like every other American out there.
Right, and it's interesting that there was a recent story that talked about how, I think it's outgrowth of the census, they thought the Asian Americans and Pacific Islander community, that those numbers were going to surpass, I think, Hispanics, down the road. That was the largest growing segment of the community. So mm-hmm. All very interesting.
Yeah, it's clearly a really diverse makeup here in the U.S., of course. And for Samoans, I mean, they're just really trying to fight for what they think is should be allowed under the 14th Amendment.
All right, we'll see where it goes. But thank you.
Thank you.
That was Associated Press reporter Sophia Yan, who is tracking a lawsuit filed by a Utah man asking for equal rights. Some are wary of the suit, though, fearing it may threaten Fa'a Samoa, the traditional social and cultural structure of the Samoan people. So the argument some see is constitutional rights versus cultural protection. This is The Conversation.
Support for The Conversation comes from Mattson, in appreciation of HPR's local public affairs programming. Since 1882, working to support Hawaii's economy and communities. Mattson.com.
Thanks to Bill Dorman and Ray Cruz at the Pledge Table. And you're back with The Conversation. A legislative audit is a standard tool for lawmakers to ensure that state agencies are operating effectively, one that is not presented to agencies as an option. But when an audit was proposed for the Hawaii Agribusiness Development Corporation, its executive director said his staff was too busy. Stuart Yurton has the story in today's reality check from Honolulu Civil Beat. Good morning, Stuart.
Good morning, Chris.
I was immediately struck by this headline because I can't think of an instance where an audit was essentially refused before. That's just sort of not done, is it?
It's pretty rare. The agency here, what's interesting about it is that the audit was tacked onto a bill that would support papaya research.
Right.
The organization is set up to help the ag industry, mm-hmm. and the executive director says, yes, this will help the papaya industry. But they oppose it anyway.
And then his position changed when an audit was tacked onto the bill. Is that correct?
That's right. Richard Cregan, the representative from the Big Island, tacked on the audit requirement, and Cynthia Thielen, the representative from here on Oahu, is also calling for the audit. And once that happened, the executive director of the Agribusiness Development Corporation said, "We don't want the audit. We don't want the support for papaya after all."
Yeah, which raises some obvious questions, and it also looks as if this is an agency with a great deal of responsibility, great deal of funds under its charge, right?
Yes, that's right, Chris. It's gotten a lot of appropriations, about $250 million in appropriations over the past 5 years. Now, if it doesn't spend all that, then it sort of lapses back to the state, and we don't know how much it's spent. The corporation has not been submitting reports to the legislature as its statute calls for. Mm-hmm. It has been submitting these so-called Act 100 reports, but those aren't required to include financial information. And in any case, they're not even fulfilling all the Act 100 criteria in the reports they are submitting.
Well, when an agency has as much money under its charge as this, we're talking about $250 million, right? The whole point of an audit is to see how money is being used to ensure that it's being efficiently distributed, yeah?
Yeah, that's right. And again, to make clear, we're not sure if it took all that $250 million. A big chunk of that was for capital appropriations or mm-hmm. capital uses, which would have been buying a bunch of land. We're just not sure how much they got. So that's one of the big questions.
It's maybe just, what, a breach of protocol? Do you think there's something more to all this?
Well, no one knows, and that's what the legislators are calling for, and that's what audits often do.
Is determine exactly what this thing is setting out to determine. Where does it go from here?
Well, there are two bills. One would actually expand the power of the Agribusiness Development Corporation, and this other bill with the papaya research and audit, they're both headed toward conference committee to be hashed out, some differences in drafts, and we'll see.
Once they get into conference committee, there's not much we know we can find out until we get a result, right?
That's correct.
Yeah, that's the big mystery at the end of the legislative session. Stuart, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Chris.
That was senior business reporter Stuart Yurton with today's reality check. And for the full story, you can visit civilbeat.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Achieve 3000, working with Hawaii's educators to provide scaffolds and supports for Tier 2 and Tier 3 intervention students and English language learners to close skill gaps. Achieve3000.com.
Playwright Ethel Fugard's The Road to Mecca, which is about to open in Honolulu at the Actors Group Theater, is about an older woman at a crisis point in her life. She's a self-taught artist in a community that doesn't quite know what to make of her. And her story can resonate with anyone who has wanted to change direction in life. Joyce Maltby is directing the production, and we spoke earlier this morning.
Helen, I guess an outsider artist who late in life realized that the life she'd been living until the age of 50 was not who she was. And at the age of 50, something within her, an impulse, started her to create sculptures, statues, which took over her whole life, and she ended up making a brilliant masterpiece out in her front yard and in her house. And it's actually a story is based on a real person who, this is true, she ended up with something called the Owl House, which mm-hmm. now is visited by hundreds of people every day in South Africa. But the description of the main character, I guess, is just that she, without thinking, what do I want to do now that I'm 50, she just, it came from her, from within her, and she started doing it, and she couldn't stop till she finished her road to Mecca.
This is a place that a lot of people find themselves at the age of 50, but few go down this path.
Right, and whatever it was that drove her to it, I don't think it was an intellectual decision. It wasn't what do I do with the rest of my life kind of thing. Her husband had died, and I think going to church, this is, of course, 1974 in New Bethesda, mm-hmm. Which is a small Karoo village in South Africa, founded by the Dutch Reformed Church, and among people who, that was what she had done until the age 50, that's mm-hmm. what all the villagers did. It was a church-going community. And
a world of very conservative, white South African
right.
settlers.
And these were, actually, this group of people were called Afrikaners.
Yes.
The group that settled there.
Descendants of the Boers and the Dutch emigres.
And so she lived in a world that couldn't understand her at all. I mean, when she started building these things, they thought of them as monstrosity. Children threw stones at the at the statues, and but she was admired by the Reverend Marius Beleveld, who is the second of the three characters in this play, mm-hmm. and he was a minister, but. Even though she stopped going to the church, he kept fighting for her soul. He kept wanting her to mm-hmm. be there, and I won't say anything more.
Well, he was coming from that very conservative place, and yet he found a way to be accepting of her direction.
Right. Well, I don't know. No, he didn't accept her direction. He never could, but he still also never could forget about her. Mm-hmm. So he and the villagers...
Oh, I see.
Started to feel that she was not capable of taking care of herself anymore. There had been a fire in the home, and they wanted to put her in an old age home.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess the central conflict here is this woman is, she needs to be who she is.
Yeah.
Create her art until she can't create it anymore. And she's living among a community that wants to put her away, and putting her away is death for her.
Well, conservative communities tend to marginalize the eccentric. They make it difficult to be eccentric,
right.
And eccentric is seen as crazy, dysfunctional,
exactly.
Needs to be put away.
Yes, it's.
But for an artist, if you're not eccentric, you're probably not much of an artist.
Right. I've learned that.
Yeah.
Yes.
So is part of it the is part of the message to the audience, go ahead and be eccentric if you want to?
Be who you are, and don't let anybody tell you that's not the way you should do things. Be who you are, I guess. And there's the third character in this play is a young woman, also based on somebody who really did exist in the real Helen Martin's life. In this case, it's a teacher, a young teacher from Cape Town, who had gone up to see this house she'd heard about. This was like 5 years before the play starts, and a great friendship started between them, and the young woman found in Helen inspiration, mm-hmm. and the two started a relationship, which was a beautiful one, and so that's what is the impetus there for this play is Helen really calls on this young woman, sends her a letter because she's desperate, because she has to sign a document. They want to put her in a home.
This situation has reached a crisis point.
Right, and so the young woman does come up there to see what she can do, not knowing exactly what the details are. All she knows is that Helen is
she's a friend.
Yeah, and that she needs help. So,
what's interesting to me about the way art came to Helen at age 50 is that it sort of, it sounds to me from your description as if it came in a sort of a pure form as opposed to going and, you know, taking lessons or something.
Exactly,
yeah. Just did what she felt like doing. And
right, it was spontaneous. It was really the true artist who just can't stop can't stop doing what is in them, what they were born to do.
When you read biographies of so many different artists, no matter what the particular art, you do sense that kind of compulsion. Almost, you know, frequently artists describe their work as something that flows through them rather than something they originate.
Yes, yes, no, exactly. And to me, it's a tribute to all artists, whether they start at age 5 or age 50, although there is something about somebody having the courage to do that at that age. But it's about the artist and society and how easy it is to place people in categories and judge them by the behavior that the society expects of people rather than see people as individuals.
Well, and also people who have reached an age where, you know, it might be the culmination of every thought they've ever had in their lives, and the world might see them as losing it.
Exactly, yeah.
And they're not, and they know it.
Right, and it's a little bit, too, about, you know, making those decisions. I know so many people are faced with, what do we do with an elderly parent? Or, you know, are they dangerous? Are they dangerous to themselves or whatever? And there is that feeling of where is the line drawn between what sometimes you have to do and sometimes you shouldn't do.
Yeah.
And in the case of Helen, they didn't get to know who she really was. They didn't. Putting her in this home was not going to be the answer for her. And in some cases, of course, it is. But for this artist, they never knew her.
It kind of makes you, you know, it kind of tells the audience in a way to take a closer look at the older people around you and maybe listen a little harder to what they're...
And listen to them, yeah. Listen not with your own... Not from where you're coming from, but listen to them from where they're coming from.
Yeah. Joyce Maltby is the director of South African playwright Ethel Fugard's The Road to Mecca at the Actors Group. It opens tomorrow and runs weekends until April 29th at the Brad Powell Theater in Honolulu. Now we take you back to Pledge Central with Bill Dorman and Ray Cruz.